that anyone who gave us information on any of the Jane Street Six, or heck, could prove he killed one, would be richly rewarded. Second, my conversation with P.T. when this all began.
We only sent two agents to the brownstone.
No backup?
No.
Should have waited. Why hadn't they waited for backup? The answer seems fairly clear now. Without another word, I turn and start back down the path. I know it all now. Leo Staunch had hinted as much to me. He told me when I found Arlo Sugarman, I would find all my answers. He was right, I realize. In terms of the Jane Street Six, there is still a bit of cleanup work to do, but I came here for answers, and now I have them. Calvin Sinclair calls after me. Wynn! I don't stop. Are you going to tell? He calls out. But I still don't stop. Chapter 31. Back on the jet, I get three calls. The first I see incoming is from PT. I don't want to talk to him quite yet. Not when I'm so close to the endgame. And so I let it go into the voicemail. This will, no doubt, displease P.T., who will quickly deduce that I am avoiding him. But I can live with that. The second call is from Kabir. Articulate, I say, opening up the browser on my laptop. Kabir will normally email me all relevant backing documentation because, again, like my daughter, I am visual. But his reply catches me off guard. I have Pierre-Emmanuel Clo on the line. He sounds upset. It takes me a second to remember the name of the art curator and restorer whom I had insisted the FBI use to authenticate and tenderly care for the family's Vermeer. I tell Kabir to patch the call through.
Mr. Lockwood?
Speaking.
This is Pierre-Emmanuel Clo at the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU.
I hear the muffled panic in his tone.
You asked me to look into a painting the FBI recently located for authentication and condition purposes, The Girl at the Piano by Johannes Vermeer.
Yes, of course.
When can you get to the Institute, Mr. Lockwood?
Is this urgent?
It is, yes.
Is there an issue with the Vermeer?
I think it's better if we discuss this in person.
I hear the quake in his voice.
As soon as possible, please.
I check the time. Depending on traffic, it should take about 3 hours in total. Will you still be there? I ask him.
The Institute will be closed, but I won't leave until you arrive.
The third call is from Ima. After I offer up my customary greeting, Ima asks, any updates? I fill her in on the day's happenings. I don't hold back. I don't sugarcoat. I do feel my heart swell, but alas, so what? As Ima might say, get over it. I finish by telling her I'm heading straight to New York University Institute of Fine Arts Conservation Center across Central Park from the Dakota.
Oh, good, Ima says. That's why I called.
Go on.
I'm going over the FBI witness transcripts for the art heist at Haverford, she continues.
And?
And the early investigators seemed convinced that it was an inside job. Most notably the night guard, Ian Cornwell. In the end, they had no proof, so they dropped it.
I tell her I know all this.
Ima says, you questioned Cornwell, right?
I did. He's a political science professor at Haverford now.
Yeah, I saw that. What did you think of him?
I do not want to prejudice her reaction. What do you think of him?
I think the original investigators got it right. There is just no way it could have worked the way Ian Cornwell claims.
Yet, I say, those investigators couldn't make the case.
Doesn't mean he didn't do it.
Doesn't mean that at all, I agree.
I hear street noise.
Where are you?
I'm heading into the subway so I can catch the train home.
I'll have someone drive you.
I'd rather do it this way, Wynn. Anyway, I don't know how, but we need to get Ian Cornwell to talk. He's the key.
Oh, and let me know what the art conservator tells you.
Ima hangs up.
I replay the conversation in my head, and I know that as I do, I have a smile on my face. I close my eyes and
try to nap for the duration of the flight. That won't happen. I am feeling itchy, antsy, and I know why. I take out my phone and find my favorite app. I set up a rendezvous for tonight at midnight with username Helena. Midnight is later than I normally do, but it seems today will be a hectic day. NYU's Institute of Fine Arts is located on Fifth Avenue in the French-styled James B. Duke House, one of the few surviving millionaire mansions from New York's Gilded Age. James Duke, yes, my beloved alma mater, Duke University, is named for his father, made his fortune as a founding partner in the American Tobacco Company, modernizing the manufacturing and marketing of cigarettes. The old adage is that behind every great fortune there is a great crime, or, as in this case, if not a great crime, the fortune was certainly built on a pile of dead bodies. The Institute has a boatload of security for obvious reasons. I pass through it all and find Pierre-Emmanuel Clos pacing alone in the second-floor conservatory. He wears a white lab coat and latex gloves. When he turns toward me, I can see something akin to terror on his face. Thank God you're here. The conservatory is a hybrid of the old-school mansion and a state-of-the-art research center. There are long tables and special lighting and tapestries and paintbrushes and scalpels and what look like microscopes and dental tools and medical testing equipment. I'm sorry for the dramatics, but I think... His voice fades out. I don't see the Vermeer, that image of the girl at the piano. The longest table holds but one item, a possible painting face down, and it is approximately the correct size of the Vermeer. Next to it sits a Phillips head screwdriver and several screws. Pierre Emmanuel walks toward it. I follow. First of all, he says, his tone steadier now, the painting is authentic. This is indeed The Girl at the Piano by Vermeer, most likely painted in 1656. There is a hushed awe in his voice. I can't tell you what an honor it is to be in its presence. I give him this moment of silence, as though this is a religious service which, for him, may be apropos. When I meet his eye, Pierre Emmanuel clears his throat. Let me get to why I so urgently needed to see you. He points to the back of the painting. First off, there was a Masonite backing board covering the entire reverse of your Vermeer. It's not original, obviously, but Masonite backings are not uncommon. They protect the painting from dust and physical impact. He glances over at me. I nod to show that I'm listening. The backing board is screwed in, so I carefully took out the screws and removed the Masonite in order to inspect the painting more thoroughly. That's the backing board over there. He points to what looks like a thin school blackboard. On it, I can see the faded Lockwood family crest. Pierre Emmanuel Clos turns his attention back to the flip side of the Vermeer. You can see here the stretcher up against the back of the canvas. That's not uncommon either, but the thing is, first you need to remove the backing. Then you need to look under the stretcher. It's not easy to do, but that's where someone hid them, under a screwed-in backing board and taped between the stretcher and the canvas. Hid what? I ask. He has it in his gloved hand. This envelope. It had probably started life as white, but it was now yellowed to the point of being near Manila. At first, he continues, his words a rushed babble now, I was so excited. I thought maybe it was a letter of historical importance. Oh, and it wasn't sealed. I wouldn't have slit it open or looked inside if that was the case. I would have just put it to the side. So what was inside, I ask. Pierre Emmanuel leads me over to a desk and points. These. I look down at the brown yet transparent images. They're film negatives, Pierre Emmanuel continues. I don't know how old they are, but most people take digital pictures nowadays, and those screws hadn't been removed in years. The shape of the negatives appears odd to my layman's eyes. You usually think of negatives as being rectangular. These, however, are perfect squares. I look at Pierre Emmanuel. His lip is now trembling. I assume you looked at them. His voice is a terrified whisper.
Only three, he manages to tell me. That's all I could handle.
He offers me a set of latex gloves. I snap them on and turn on his lamp. I carefully lift one of the negatives with the pads of my thumb and forefinger. I raise it to the light. Pierre Emmanuel has taken a step back, but I know that he is watching my face. I show nothing, but I feel the jolt everywhere. I gently put the negative back and move to a second, then a third, then a fourth. I still show nothing, but there is an eruption going on inside. I won't lose control, not yet. But the rage is coming. I will need a way to channel it. After I view 10 of the negatives, I say to him, I'm sorry you had to see these.
Do you know who those girls are?
I do. More than that, I know where the photographs were taken. In the Hut of Horrors. Chapter 32. It is dark by the time I arrive at the faculty housing area of Haverford College. I drove myself from the airport because I want no one around. I drive fast. I drive with a fury. When Ian Cornwell sees me at his door at this late hour, he is unsure how to react. Part of him still fears my name and how important my family is to this institution, but more of him, I have come to believe, wants nothing to do with me or the awful past I keep dragging back to his doorstep.
It's late, Ian Cornwell tells me as I stand on his stoop. He blocks the door so that I cannot enter. I already told you everything I know.
I nod. Then, without warning, I punch him hard in the stomach. He folds at the waist as though it has hinges. I shove him inside and close the door behind me. The punch was well placed, so as to knock the wind out of him. His eyes are wide with fear as he retches, seeking air. I know that I should feel bad, but, as I explained previously, violence gives me a rush. It would be dumb to lie and pretend otherwise. He drops to the ground. Having the wind knocked out of you just means the impact to your celiac plexus causes a temporary diaphragmatic spasm. It doesn't last. I pull over a chair and sit next to him. I wait until he can breathe. Through gritted teeth, Cornwell says,
"Get out!
Look at these." Pierre Emmanuel helped me make rudimentary reproductions of two of the negatives. I drop them next to him. He looks at them, and then he looks back at me in abject horror.
These were hidden in the frame of the Vermeer, I say. I don't understand.
These girls, I continue, are victims from the Hut of Horrors. His eyes go wide again, a mixture of fear and total confusion. It doesn't compute for him, not yet.
What does that have to do?
I don't have time for this, Ian, so I'll ask you one more time. What really happened the night of the heist? He puts his hand on his stomach and rolls into a sit. The stomach will be sore tomorrow. I can see his mind searching for a way out, and what that tells me, with very little doubt, is that Ian Cornwell knows more than he is saying. I say, very little doubt rather than no doubt, because, of course, I can be fooled as easily as anyone. The stupidest men are the ones who think they can't be wrong. The stupidest men are the ones who are most sure. The stupidest men are the ones who don't know what they don't know. But right now, if I were to hypothesize, Professor Ian Cornwell is stalling so that he can rummage through all the possibilities. Showing him two sickening images of the 15-year-old victim we will call Jane Doe. In both, she is naked, on her stomach, and trussed with barbed wire.
was of course designed to shock him into revealing the truth. Now, however, I wonder whether I went too far, if the images will cause paralysis rather than openness. My concern now is that his brain is working thusly. Suppose, he may be wondering, he does confess to something involving the art heist. Will that now link him to these unspeakable crimes? Could he end up being charged as an accessory? Silence has worked for him so far. Silence eventually got the FBI to leave him be. Silence has kept him out of prison. His wheels are churning. I give him another second, perhaps two, and then he looks up at me with pleading eyes.
I wish I could help you,
Ian Cornwell predictably begins. But I'm telling the truth. I don't know anything. Many martial arts specialize in what we commonly call pressure points, that is, pressing or striking sensitive nerve clusters in order to cause pain. I would not advise using them in a real fight. In a real fight, you're in constant motion, and your opponent is in constant motion. That is two moving targets, thereby making strikes with the pinpoint accuracy these techniques rely upon unrealistic. Pressure points, when done well, can cause excruciating pain, though you never know your opponent's pain threshold. Opponents often react by squirming away at such a grip with suddenly alarming strength. My, pardon the pun, pressure point? Pressure points work best in more passive situations. They are, if you will, pain compliance techniques. If you want to safely but effectively escort a drunk patron out of a pub, for example, or break a hold, they can be useful. If, for a more vivid and immediate example, you want to cause enough distress to induce someone to cooperate, pressure points can be frighteningly efficient. I won't go into much technical detail, but I grab his hair with one hand to hold him in place. Using my opposing thumb, I dig deep into his neck, more specifically, the upper trunk of the brachial plexus above the clavicle known as Herb's Point. Ian Cornwell's body convulses as though I had hit him with a stun gun, which, come to think of it, I should have brought. He tries to let out a gnarled scream. I pull back my thumb suddenly, giving him a second of relief, but I don't stop there. I move quickly to another spot on the underside of the bicep, squeeze hard, cover his mouth. Then I go back to Herb's Point, pushing down on the nerve bundle even harder. Ian Cornwell thrashes impotently, like a freshly caught fish dropped on a dock. I straddle him now, pin him down, and go after the pressure point on the underside of the jaw. His body stiffens. Then I move up to the temples, then back to the neck. I put my fingers together, forming two spears, and shove those spears deep into that hollow beneath both ears. When I jerk up hard on his skull back, his head jerks and his eyes roll back. Of course, I could be wrong. We have established that already. Ian Cornwell may have been telling the truth from the get-go, that he didn't know anything, that he is innocent, that he was indeed tied up by two masked men. If that is the case, we will soon know for certain, and yes, I will feel bad for what I've done to him. Violence is a high, but I'm not a sadist. That may sound like I'm threading an awfully thin needle, but I do experience empathy, and if I hurt an innocent man, I will feel bad about it. But life is a series of close calls, of weighing pros and cons, and if both Ima and I, not to mention the original FBI investigators, believe that Ian Cornwell has not been truthful, the pros of crossing this particular line win out. And so I continue my assault, methodically, expressionless, until he cracks and tells me everything. Well, that was interesting. Here is what Professor Ian Cornwell told me. 3 months before the Vermeer and Picasso theft, young Ian Cornwell, a Haverford research assistant, 1 year removed from graduating, met a lovely lass named Belinda Evans at a local pizzeria. Belinda was, according to Ian Cornwell, a knockout with long blonde hair and sun-kissed skin. He fell hard. At first, Belinda claimed to be a junior attending Villanova University, but as their relationship progressed, she admitted to her new beau that she still attended nearby Radnor High School as a sophomore. Her parents, she said, were very strict, so they would have to keep their relationship a secret. Ian Cornwell concurred. He did not want his relationship with a high school girl, a sophomore at that, to be made public, thereby harming his chances for academic and career advancement. This, of course, presented a problem for a budding romance. Simply put, where to hook up? Her home with these strict parents was a no-no, as was Ian's campus suite, which he shared with three other research assistants who would definitely gossip. Belinda suggested a solution. Ian worked nights alone as a security guard in Founders Hall. The work was, to put it mildly, uneventful. Haverford was a sleepy campus. Ian spent most nights alone at the security desk, reading and studying. What if, Belinda proposed, he could sneak her into Founders Hall, where they could spend hours late at night, alone? Ian readily and excitedly agreed. The young lovebirds met up this way, Ian estimated, approximately 10 times over a 3-month period. Ian fell harder and harder for Belinda. The routine was a simple one. Belinda would go to the locked back entrance. There was a primitive security camera back there. Ian would see her via the monitor at his desk. She would wave and smile. He would come back, let her in, and you can guess the rest. But on one special night, the night of the heist, obviously, when Ian unlocked that back door after seeing Belinda on the monitor, a man burst in wearing a ski mask and brandishing a handgun. At first, Ian thought the man had forced Belinda at gunpoint, but it soon became apparent that that wasn't the case. They were working together, Belinda and this man in the ski mask. He held the gun on Ian, while Belinda explained in the calmest voice, one Ian had never heard her use before, the situation. How they would tie Ian up. How Ian would tell the authorities that two men had fooled him by pretending to be policemen. How the M.O. would appear similar to the Gardner Museum heist in Boston, so as to throw them off. Belinda did all the talking. The man in the ski mask just held the gun. Belinda told Ian Cornwell that if he ever talked, she would tell the authorities that the heist had been Ian's idea. Ian was, after all, the inside source. She also reminded Ian that there was not much he could offer the police anyway. He couldn't identify the man in the ski mask, and, as for Belinda herself, nothing she had told him was the truth. She did not attend Radnor High School. Her name was not Belinda. After tonight, he would never see her again. Even if he told the police the truth, the leads would be scant. Ian would only be incriminating himself, she reminded him. He had, after all, sneaked a high school girl into Founders Hall over a 3-month period. At best, Ian would be expelled for that indiscretion and academically tarnished. To further emphasize her seriousness, Belinda told Ian that if he did talk, they would come back and kill him. As she gave him that final warning, the man in the ski mask grabbed Ian by the scruff of his neck and pushed the muzzle of the gun into his eye. The morning after the art heist, when Ian was found tied up, he debated coming clean and telling the truth, but the FBI agents were so aggressive, so sure that he was involved, Ian feared that everything Belinda told him would come to pass would. He would take the fall. Suppose, after he spilled his guts, they never found Belinda or the man in the ski mask. Would the FBI be satisfied, or would they need a convenient fall guy, a guy who, at best, showed poor enough judgment to let one of the two thieves repeatedly trespass? It was clear to Ian that he had to remain silent and write it out. As long as he didn't trip himself up, the FBI had nothing on him, because, alas, he was innocent. That was the delicious irony. The only way they would be able to nail Ian for anything was if he told the truth about the fact that he didn't do anything. I asked Ian, Did you ever see Belinda Evans again?
When he hesitated, I made the spear shape with my fingers.
Yes, he said.
Many years later. He couldn't be sure it was Belinda, he said, though I think that's a lie. He was sure.
The late-night sex with username Helena is not very good. After I leave Ian Cornwell, it is too late to do more sleuthing. I'm not sure that I need to do more immediate work anyway. I know it all now. There are a few loose ends, but if I let all this evidence settle for a few hours, plus having Kabir and my team spend the night nailing down a few additional details, I firmly believe all will become clear in the morning. So, with that rationale in my mind, I keep my sex app appointment with username Helena. She is willing and enthusiastic, and I am disappointed and surprised that I do not respond in kind. I find myself distracted. I know it appears that I am casual with sex, but the truth is very much the opposite. Sex is sacred to me. It is the closest thing I will ever know to religious euphoria. Many people feel like this in church, or on a runner's high, or, in Myron's case, when Springsteen plays Meeting Across the River, followed by Jungleland in concert. For me, it only happens during sex. Sex is the excellent adventure, the grand voyage from which we completely disembark the moment we slip out of this bed. For me, sex is best when you have a, to use a business phrase I absolutely detest, shared vision. Tonight, there was simply too much static for a connection. It was merely a release, not all that different from masturbation. As we lie back in silence, catching our breaths, eyes on the ceiling, username Helena says, "That was nice." I say nothing. I debate a round two. Perhaps that will put me more in the zone. But I'm not as young as I used to be, and it is getting late. I am idly wondering how we two will transition to exiting when my phone rings. It is Kabir. The time is 2 a.m. This can't be good news. Articulate, I say. We have a big problem.
Chapter 33.
You found Arlo Sugarman.
It has been 12 hours since Kabir's phone call. My adrenaline spike has subsided, the crash thus imminent. I have not slept, and I can feel myself fraying at the edges. Stamina is a large part of my training, but genetically, I am not predisposed to it. I am also aging, which obviously hampers stamina, and I have very little real-world experience in needing it. I have rarely had to stay up all night on patrol, as one might in the military, or been forced to go days on end with no sleep. I do battle, and then I rest. The old woman speaking to me now is Vanessa Hogan. I am back at her house in Kings Point. We are alone. Jessica set this up for me. At first, Vanessa Hogan was reluctant to consent to a second meeting. The enticement that pushed her over the edge, as I suspected it would, was that she and I would meet alone, only the two of us, and I would tell her the whereabouts of Arlo Sugarman.
"Could we start with you?" I ask her.
Vanessa Hogan is propped up via pillows on the same couch. Her tone is rosier than at our last meeting. She appears less frail. A scarf still covers her head. The house is empty. She'd sent her son Stuart to the grocery store.
"I really don't know what you mean."
"I recently visited Billy Rowan's father," I say. "Do you know he and Edie Parker's mother are something of an item?"
"I did not,"
Vanessa says, her voice dripping something overly sticky.
"How nice for them."
"Yes. William Rowan is in assisted living. His room is filled with Christian imagery. There are framed Bible quotes on the wall. I found the contrast striking."
"What contrast?"
"With your home," I say, lifting both hands in the air. "I don't even see a single cross." She shrugs.
"That's show religion,"
Vanessa replies with a tinge of bitterness.
That doesn't mean anything.
Alone, you're correct, it wouldn't.